players. The White Sox and the Cardinals have the day off. And the scene is set for the Stanley Cup Final, the best-of-seven series, which starts this Saturday in Detroit. We'll pit the Red Wings against the Pittsburgh Penguins. Detroit qualified by beating Chicago in overtime last night, 2-1, eliminating the Blackhawks from the Western Conference Final in five games.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Busey Bank, Urbana; Jupiter's Pizzeria and Billiards, Champaign; Unitarian Universalist Church, Urbana; and Illini Studio, Champaign. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
Say it loud! I'm back and I'm proud!
What do JCPenney's and McDonald's have in common? Discrimination against blacks in the early 1900s.
They marched on Penney's because Penney's were not hiring blacks.
Hear the firsthand stories of Champaign residents Irma Bridgewater and Ruby Hunt. Youth Media Workshop, a service of Illinois Public Media, presents I Remember, I Believe, Mondays and Tuesdays in June at 4:45 and 6:45 p.m.
It's 2:41. 4 days remain until the scheduled adjournment of Illinois' spring legislative session. After months of trying to figure a way out of a huge budget mess, state lawmakers are still looking for answers. The final solution could leave everyone unhappy, Sean Crawford reports.
Back on March 18th, Governor Pat Quinn told lawmakers what they already knew. The state was sinking fast in a sea of red ink. Years of spending more than the state was taking in made things bad. An economic recession made it all worse. A $12 billion deficit. Quinn's thought, raise the income tax. A 50% tax hike would patch the budget hole and make sure critical services continue to those who need them. But piece by piece, Quinn has seen his budget proposal be taken apart and thrown on the General Assembly's scrap heap. House Speaker Mike Madigan, appearing on Public TV's Illinois Lawmakers program, made it clear the tax plan lacks enough votes.
I think that many legislators that are concerned about a vote for an income tax increase are concerned about other people in our society who maybe are out of work, maybe they're working less hours, and this would be taking money out of their pocket. I think that's the big concern.
Quinn has made concessions. Most recently, he agreed to lower the tax exemption he'd wanted to give low-income families and offer more property tax relief. But Mike Noland, an Elgin Democratic senator, says it's not enough.
An absolute must component for my vote on this bill has to be property tax relief, and it has to be significant. It has to be measurable, and my voters need to be able to see it, you know. And I don't get the sense that we've come up with a plan to make that happen.
Noland says voters in his district want the state to cut spending and show government is efficient. The same is true downstate in Senator Bill Haynes' district. The Alton Democrat is ready to support the income tax increase because he says the alternative would be terrible. Cuts to social services, education, and other areas. But Haynes says Quinn and others have failed to drive home that message.
Most citizens are opposed to a tax increase. That's the fact. They're not happy. And I don't blame them. You know what? I don't blame them. The case hasn't been made as yet. It has to me, but my people are not happy campers, I'll tell you that.
That unwillingness of the public to accept more taxes and the concern over deep budget cuts leaves lawmakers few other options. But those might include some sort of temporary spending plan that would keep government operating for part of the year until a decision is made on how to pay for the rest of it. The Senate president downplayed that possibility, although others say nothing is off the table. Democrats control the legislature and the entire process in Springfield. They can pass a budget on their own. But earlier this week, Democratic leaders asked Republicans for help solving the budget problem. Senate GOP leader Christine Redonio bristled at the thought.
For 6 years, Republicans have said, don't adopt these budgets. You're spending too much money. We're going to have a day of reckoning here. There's not going to be enough money to pay for everything. And guess what? The day of reckoning is here, and now suddenly they want to involve us in the bailout.
Redonio says had the process been more bipartisan through the years, she suspects the outcome would be different. She says none of the Republican senators are willing to back a tax hike at this time, and a spokesperson for House Republicans adds the same holds true in that chamber. All of it adds up to a cloudy vision of how this legislative session will end and when that will happen. Senate President John Cullerton had previously said he wanted to be done by Friday, allowing him to attend his daughter's graduation ceremony. Now his spokesperson says he's telling his staff to be prepared to stay until the last scheduled day on Sunday, and others are already making plans in case the session drags past May and into overtime, where even more votes, including Republicans, would be needed to pass a budget. I'm Sean Crawford.
In the United States, a gay pride parade with 200 participants may not receive much notice, but it's a different story in Romania, where University of Illinois journalism students are reporting on that country's evolution. Romania decriminalized homosexuality only 8 years ago. Gays are viewed with hostility by much of the conservative public. Bucharest's 2007 Gay Fest ended in tear gas and violence. This year, hundreds of police officers surrounded the parade route. Police blocked off the area to any anti-gay protesters. About 200 gay activists, including several members of the European Union Parliament, attended the event. One participant explained to reporter Karis Moral what it's like to be gay in Romania.
This mask represents the personality we have to wear until things will become normal here. This nation is very, very conservative, and people are booed when other people find out that you are gay or something. Being gay is not something to be afraid of. We're not sick or anything. We're normal people like they are, you know? The whistles is for letting people know that we are here to stay, we're not going anywhere, and they don't have any other choice but to accept us. They will accept us. I don't know if in the next 5 years, but hopefully in the near future.
An audio postcard from a gay pride parade in Bucharest, Romania. One of the many faces of a country that U of I students are presenting in their reporting work this summer, AM 580 will bring us a documentary produced by those students on Romania's transition. You may have experienced the frustration of walking into a bookstore and being told the book is not in stock or out of print. One company is trying to make books on demand. They can be printed one at a time while you wait. Some are calling this one of the most significant steps in publishing in the last 500 years. The company has installed a trial machine at a bookstore in central London. NPR's Rob Gifford went to take a look.
Marcus Gibbs is in love with a machine, or at least it sometimes seems that way.
Effectively, it's a great big office printer stuck to a rather lovely, in my opinion, but perhaps not the most aesthetically pleasing collection of technology.
The friendly, bespectacled bookseller is floor manager of Blackwell's Bookstore on London's Charing Cross Road, perhaps the most bookish corner of one of the world's most bookish cities. The machine he's gazing lovingly at is the new espresso machine. Nothing to do with coffee beans, this baby's grinding out books.
The printer runs at about 100 pages a minute, so, I mean, you can work out for yourself how quickly you can get things done.
The machine then sticks and binds the pages together itself, and out comes a book. A real book, just the same as all the other books on Blackwell's shelves. Marcus Gibbs says they already have 500,000 titles saved digitally on the espresso ready to print. That's five times the number they have on the shop floor. And within 3 months, they should have more than 1 million available. He says it's changing the whole way people will look at purchasing books.
I just typed in my surname and I looked for a few things and I found a book by my great-granduncle, which he wrote in 1901 and was published in Shanghai. I printed that off my dad, it made his day. We've been printing off stuff like Darwin's early work. I mean, nobody really wants Darwin's work on earthworms, which was one of his first published books. There's a small market for it on the second-hand market where it goes for about £500, £600 normally, even in a tatty condition. We printed one off for a customer and he walked out with it and it was £10.
That's a bargain at $15. And what that means is that in future, if other smaller bookstores get one of these machines, not cheap to be sure, at about $175,000, they'll be able to compete much better with bigger stores, with internet stores, and also with the rise of electronic books. The company that makes the espresso, On Demand Books in New York, calls it an ATM for books. CEO Dane Neller says it's the biggest revolution in publishing since Gutenberg started printing more than 500 years ago. He says it will certainly keep paper books way ahead of electronic books such as the Amazon Kindle.
You're right that our technology now makes possible for the printed page to move as rapidly as the electronic page. Still, the printed book still remains overwhelmingly the dominant way books are read. I mean, I think the last statistic I saw worldwide, the electronic book is still less than 0.5%. I think it will grow, but I still think the printed book will be the dominant way people consume literature.
Back at Blackwell's in London, in addition to the out-of-print authors and the academic authors, there's another type of author who's helped by the espresso machine.
My name's Jennifer Brown, and I'm here because I popped out of my work lunch hour because I finished my first book about a month ago and I really wanted to get it published, so this seemed a perfect opportunity.
There she stands, fulfilling her childhood dream, an author holding a copy of her own newly printed first novel, entitled Abstractions of Feeling. Now trying to find an agent and a publisher, Jennifer Brown loves the espresso machine.
Wonderful, makes you feel like a real author. Really feels like all that hard work is worthwhile. And now even if I don't get a publisher, I'll have something to give to my friends to show them that I've done something, I've achieved something.
Books on Demand say they have 5 machines already available to the public in the United States. They plan 25 around the world by the end of this year, and hope to have several thousand worldwide within 5 years. Rob Gifford, NPR News, London.
It's 2:52. Researchers have found an opportunity for public education in a Hollywood blockbuster. The Da Vinci Code offered a rich backdrop of religious history in laying out its plot, and in its sequel, Angels and Demons, author Dan Brown injects physics. The Vatican is threatened by a bomb planted by the shadowy organization, the Illuminati. The bomb's explosive charge is based on antimatter stolen from CERN, the Swiss particle physics laboratory that produces antimatter in its Large Hadron Collider. Physicists want to step in here with some caveats, and two of them are making a presentation about the reality of antimatter tomorrow night on the University of Illinois campus. Professor Kevin Pitt says CERN, the collider, and antimatter are very real, but antimatter's potential is just beginning to be realized.
The amount of antimatter that they have and they can actually take is immeasurable compared to the amounts that we can actually make in laboratories.
Is there a worry that there's that distinction between fiction and fact in this movie, that there's misinformation about what antimatter really is? Does this count as dramatic license, or is this something that ought to be either corrected or obviously explained?
We would like to take the opportunity to explain it, but we're certainly don't have a problem with the fictional account of the antimatter and the science behind that. For example, there's a lot of fiction in Star Trek that is that is not science fact, but it's still very fun to watch and enjoyable. And so it's not that we have a problem per se with the technical details, but we are taking this opportunity to clarify that some of the actual science fact is actually is just as exciting as the science fiction.
Is there a 30-second layman version of what antimatter is without going into obviously the very complex things behind it?
We're made of particles. You probably remember from your science class protons, neutrons, and electrons. And in fact, nature allows for particles like protons and neutrons to have what are known as antiparticles. These particles still have mass. They would have weight and take up space, but they would carry the opposite electrical charge of for example, a proton would have an antimatter counterpart, which is known as an antiproton. It's a real particle which we can produce. What's special about antimatter is when it comes into contact with matter, the mass of the weight of these particles can be converted into pure energy. So that's actually very interesting in the fact that you can have this very efficient transfer of mass into energy. That goes back to Einstein in E equals MC squared.
How much energy can that produce, though? I ran across one quote saying that if you put together all of the antimatter that CERN has produced so far, and we're talking about incredibly minute quantities, I guess, you'd be able to power a light bulb for a few moments.
That's right. Another way we like to say it is that if you take all the antimatter that's ever been produced, you could probably warm up about one cup of coffee. The transfer of mass into energy is incredibly efficient. The problem or the limitation is the minute quantities of antimatter that we can produce, and that's we were actually calculating I should also say that there's a laboratory here in northern Illinois known as Fermilab,
right,
where, in fact, I do my research and a lot of us do research as well, which is very closely related to the laboratory in CERN in terms of our physics reach. And if we look at how quickly we can make antimatter today, and we say, how long would it take us to make the quantity that was used in the movie? That is about 100 million years for us to get to a quarter of a gram of antimatter, which is what was used to make the bomb in the movie.
But as we see with computers and memory, the old standby logic is that things multiply over time. So how much of a leap do we have to get between what we're producing now and something that could be useful, much less weapons grade?
Well, I think you're exactly right that there's always a possibility for major technological improvements. But one of the things that's important to note about antimatter and in fact, one of the things we want to talk about in the public lecture is that it's not really a viable energy source in the long term, because the amount of energy you needed to create the antimatter is actually much more than you would ever get out of it. And so even with technological advances that might make it much more efficient or easy for us to make antimatter, the amount of energy that would go into that is way, way larger than the energy you get out. In the case of a bomb, of course, it's spectacular to get all the energy out momentarily. But then, in fact, if you look back over how long it took you to put that energy in, you had harnessed more energy to make the antimatter than you would ever hope to get out of it.
U of I physics professor Kevin Pitts adds that transporting any amount of antimatter is currently about as impractical as you can get. He says science isn't even close to the point where antimatter can go from place to place in a battery-operated case, like in the movie. Pitts and fellow professor Mark Neubauer hold their Angels and Demons lecture night at Loomis Lab in Urbana tomorrow night at 7.
Earth and Sky.
So I don't think anybody expects to go to Mars and find, cats and dogs walking around, but there's still a good chance that there's microbial life in the deep subsurface. And so the same thing here on Earth.
You're listening to astrobiologist Paul Davies of Arizona State University. Davies studies the possibilities of life beyond Earth. He said that scientists are now studying below the seafloor near deep-sea volcanic vents and at Earth's icy poles for microbes that might be analogs of extraterrestrial life.
Most microbes haven't been characterized, let alone had their genes sequenced. So it's entirely possible that in that microbial realm is what we like to call a shadow biosphere. It doesn't mean that it's sort of shadowy in the mystical sense. It just means that we don't yet know what it is. We don't recognize it for what it is. We